Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very excited to speak to Jianglin Li about her book titled When the Iron Bird Flies, China's Secret War in Tibet, which has just been published in 2022 from Stanford University Press in English. And this is really quite an interesting book because it looks at a really important episode in Chinese history, in Tibetan history, that we generally, a lot of us in the West, in China, in Tibet, don't really know a lot about, which is what actually happened between 1956 and 1962 in the region of Tibet when the current Chinese government took control over it. So this is a really important book on a lot of levels. And Jianglin, I'm really pleased that you're with us on the podcast to tell us about it.
Hello. Thanks for inviting me. This book, as you said, is about that specific period of time. And it was originally published in Chinese. And I'm glad that the English version is coming out so we can understand more more in detail what happened during that time.
To give us a background to our discussion about the book, could you introduce yourself a little bit and explain sort of how you came to write this book?
I was born and brought up in China. Both my parents are communists. They used to be in the army and they fought during the Civil War. I mean, the communists and the nationalists. So in a way, we call that a red family. And that was, of course, everything I know about Chinese history and Tibetan history was a fixed narrative from the CCP's historical books. I didn't know anything about Tibet when I was in China. The first Tibetan I actually met was in New York when I came out. But I survived the Cultural Revolution when it lasted for 10 years. So that made me think about a lot of things which kind of went against the standard party narratives. In early 1980s, there's a lot of historical facts about the Civil War, anti-Japanese wars, etc. came out, which kind of like shattered many of my beliefs. So eventually I decided I just want to find out what was the historical facts about the so-called Tibetan issue. Why Tibet became an issue, and what made it become an issue? What kind of issue it is? It's just that from here.
I can see how that would be a big question that would lead to such a massive amount of work and research that went into both the Chinese language version of the book and, of course, this English version of the book. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about sort of the differences between the two versions. What is, you know, what has extended in this book compared to the earlier version?
Yeah, the Chinese version was written for the Chinese audience. And my understanding was when I was writing that book, that my Chinese audience would be the same as me. We all were brought up and kind of like being taught about Tibet in a way, like the way I grew up, and Tibet was a backwater, barbarous, darkness, and so on. But to convince trying to convince the Chinese audience what the situation was and what really happened is more difficult than the English audience. And that's why in the Chinese version, I had a lot of direct quotations from secret documents, and the speeches, song. Most of those quotations were taken out in English, in the English translation, in this process, because it's not only it's tedious, and another thing is I don't really need to convince the English audience what the situation basically was. And all I need to do is kind of like let people know what I found out, like the statistics and the sources and the process, the comeback, the war, in relatively more detail. And also, the English version was published like around 10 years after the Chinese version. So during those 10 years, I didn't stop the research. So there were more sources coming out, especially the documents, more documents came surfaced, and the more details are surfaced, and all the generation that cadres and the soldiers, they participated in those events, kind of aging, and they are eager to write about their memoirs, and many of those memoirs came out. So I added a lot of those into the English version, which is not in the Chinese version.
That makes a lot of sense. 10 years is a long time for more to come out. And I'm glad you mentioned sources, because I think one of the key reasons that so many people don't know about these events is that they're secret, is that the government doesn't talk about it. So how do we know about these things? How did you find these documents and get these sources?
It's an interesting thing. All those documents were kept like secret for many years. Starting from 1980s, something started to loose out a little bit. So something came out during that time. And of course, in 1980s, I didn't pay any attention to this, but it was floating around and it got collected by other foreign libraries and in Taiwan, in Hong Kong, in India. And also later, later recent years, many of those collections of like document collections were collected in online databases for researchers. And people didn't really, who put those documents into the database, probably didn't really understand their importance to researchers. So many of them were, even though classified as a secret, was somehow got into those databases. And I downloaded a lot in academic libraries in Hong Kong, in Taiwan. And so most of them were open publications, like in county and province, there's annuals. And you just have to sort through tons of them and pick out the information, connect them together to, it will come, you know, the result is a big picture. It's quite clear right in front of you, but it's just a lot of detailed work. Hmm. And of course, I've been traveling to Hong Kong, Taiwan, India, and many of them were, many of the documents also were collected in American libraries.
Hmm. A lot of work, really a lot of work went into this to produce such a clear account. And given how many documents you looked at and how long you've been doing this, was there any kind of moment in particular that was where you read something where you were really surprised, like, whoa, I didn't expect to find that there, or something like that, that you could tell us about?
Yeah, first of all, I didn't expect what happened was actually war. Because for years, people understand this as suppression of rebellion. That's the term used in Chinese, in China. And in outside China, people also use this term without actually understanding what method was used to suppress the rebellion. And this is not like a street fight, a street protest, and the government send the policemen to crack down, to shut down, something like that. It's actually the Chinese government used a very powerful military force, including Air Force, to fight Tibetans for 6 years. It is actually a war. And another thing was, why did Chinese government do this? That was a question when I kept asking myself. It didn't make sense. They knew whom they were fighting for, and why use such powerful military force? Why even Air Force? Until I found the Mao's directives, and to they take the opportunity to train the army in the actual war on the plateau, because that was the region the Han Chinese know nothing about. They knew, and so when you think about only a few months, around 6 months after they stopped the war, or you can say they won the war in Tibet, fighting Tibetans, they immediately started war against India, then the border conflict was the official term. But by the time they started fighting India, all this logistics and racing and the experience is already there. So it served several purposes. And everything, it was quite a shock to me. It was hidden so deep.
Well, I think that's really important to understand kind of how buried it was, and also sort of that the goals were a lot broader than kind of that term of putting down rebellion suggests. So now that we have that overview, I'd love to kind of go to the beginning of this period, to 1956. And can you help us understand why armed resistance broke out in the Tibetan plateau in this year?
There was a time China started to push what they call democratic reform, which is actually a series of social engineering programs. The purpose was to completely destroy Tibetans' traditional socioeconomic system and replace it with the Chinese system and political system, economic system, etc., and the ideological system. So that caused this whole idea of so-called democratic reform, and the methodologies used was completely against the Tibetan tradition. So there's a big clash, And Tibet, it doesn't started with like big scale. It was small scale, and eventually escalated into a war.
And why did the Chinese want to completely change the Tibetan system?
That's based on the CCP's basic ideology, because as Mao Zedong in his first telegraph, I think it was sent from Moscow in January 1950. He made it very clear. Tibet, he wanted to occupy Tibet and then reform into a so-called People's Democratic Tibet, which means CCP not only wanted to occupy Tibet, it also wanted to change Tibet. And the Tibet entire social situation and the social condition and the social structure is completely different with the Han Chinese. So Mao insisted they want to do this. They are not going, I think Zhou Enlai also mentioned that. There's no way you can keep a different system in, they call the serfdom system, inside a socialist system. So they're going to change it sooner or later. And when they signed the agreement, even though it mentioned in the 17-point agreement that they are not going to change it, but that's not really true. So this is another thing of research about modern Tibet, is when you see the CCP's documents, they usually say one thing, but in practice, they did another thing. You can't take the documents or something purely for its face value.
Hmm. Can you tell us more about the 17 points? Where did that kind of come from and what actually happened?
Yeah, there's a lot of writings about 17 points agreement. That was the thing, is like in October 1950, there were two things happened inside China. The same month, PRA, the Chinese military, entered Korea and participated in the Korean War. At the same time, same month, they fought a war in Tibet, in Chengdu, and conquered Chengdu. And because the whole world was paying attention to the Korean War, so much lesser attention was paid to what happened in Tibet. So in this battle, Chinese call it the Battle of Chengdu, the main force of Tibetan army was defeated. And that's, then Mao stopped that there. They didn't go right into Tibet. The reason was, one thing, they didn't know what's inside of Tibet. And the second, they wanted to stop and see what the international reaction was. And of course, the international reaction is much more in focusing on the Korean War. So they stopped for a while. They decided to have an agreement with, basically signing a treaty with Tibet, so they don't have to fight a long war into it. So there's a lot of writings about how this agreement was made. And at that time, Dalai Lama was on the border, ready to escape into India. And eventually, they signed the agreement, which actually, when in one of my interviews, Dalai Lama himself told me, the seal they used was not original seal. They just made a seal in Beijing and used this I think delegation's name. They made a seal and use that for agreement. And the agreement have 17, like, points. That's why it's called a 17 points agreement. And I wouldn't go to detail because you can really find it, easily find out in Wiki. But so in this way, Chinese army just enter Tibet and occupy Tibet. That's what I mean. It's a central Tibet, today's Tibet autonomous region. And the other part of Tibet, like Kang and Andor, that was occupied way before that.
And politics is obviously one part of this, but you economic aspect is also a key part. And if we know about sort of the CCP's history in the rest of China, obviously collectivization, land reform are things that are happening throughout the country. What did land reform and collectivization look like during this takeover of the Tibetan region?
In each, Tibet, the three different Tibetan regions, Kang, Andor, and Central Tibet, it's different time and different way of doing that. And it started in Yunnan, which is a part of Kang. And also, Tibet has like different economical system. Some of them are farmers, some of them are nomads. And so they also did this in a different way. They started from agricultural regions, then first, and then a couple of years later, they started in nomadic regions. It's particularly difficult for Tibetans because land is very scarce. Not that many land available to distribute. And another thing is the monasteries owned a lot of land. So when you want to distribute the land, you have to take the land from the monasteries. And people didn't like that because of the traditionally, people, traditionally, let's say, monasteries serve a lot of different purposes. And in difficult times, people really count on the monasteries for a lot of help. And many reasons that did cause the Tibetans resistance, but this is one of the major reasons is the destruction of Tibetan Buddhism and the monastery.
So anyone who's been to the Tibetan region or to Tibet itself and or has maybe seen pictures of Tibetan monasteries, they're quite large, right? And as you said, they own a lot of land. So could you tell us about the Iron Bird from the title? How were these monasteries destroyed?
I did quite a lot of research on the destruction of Tibetan Buddhism. It's also started from different regions. Eventually pushed into Central Tibet. In regions like Dalai Lama's birthplace, that was a mixed ethnically mixed region. It started as early as 1953, but later on in purely Tibetan regions, which means Tibetans were a majority of the population, it started in 1958. Some of them were destroyed during the war. They just like bombed it. And when something happened, Tibetans will escape into monastery. And also some monks also participated in the resistance. And there are many cases, especially in Qinghai and Sichuan, the PRA just surrounded the monastery, and it became a battleground, actually. And during the process, the monastery were destroyed. And later on, starting from 1958, CCP started a movement called religious system reform, which is also a part of the democratic reform. This movement just aimed at destroying Tibetan religion, and especially the monasteries. And during this process, majority, more than 90% of Tibetan monasteries were either closed or reused as schools, offices, warehouses, etc. And monks were sent back to their lay life, become they called the production power. So by the time during the Cultural Revolution, that time, it was Tibetan monasteries basically all gone. And I would like to point out one thing. Many people believe Tibetan monasteries were destroyed during the Cultural Revolution, which is not really true. Majority of the monasteries were destroyed during this 6 years. And the Cultural Revolution was another wave of destruction. It basically destroyed whatever left after that.
And from a sort of military standpoint, can you tell us more about sort of what the military side of this actually looked like? Kind of what were the weapons used or tactics, and kind of help us understand sort of what it would have been like on the ground, I suppose.
On the battleground, yeah, I wrote several chapters about the actual fighting and the statistics. In the last chapter, it's all about statistics, including the PRA studies, how many troops used, what branches of the military used. What you can imagine in your mind, you can see is on the one side is the tribal people. On the other side was a formal military force, and especially the main force used during this war was the force that fought in Korean War. And this 54th Army was called from Korea directly into Tibetan regions to start the training, then quickly sent into Tibetan Plateau in Qinghai to fight. And this army then in 1959 transferred to Central Tibet. It's a totally asymmetry war. The Tibetans, most of the Tibetans got involved, caught in the battles, were not even fighting, not even men. They didn't even, you know, the situation where you can picture in your mind was during that 6 years. Tibetans were escaping from everywhere. And the Qinghai, from Sichuan, they tried to escape into Central Tibet. When some of them got into Central Tibet, and they found out Central Tibet also was a war zone. So they tried to escape to India. And during this time, they were caught by cavalry, PRA cavalry or Air Force, and the Air Force just bombed them. Whatever they seen, when they saw tents on the like a group of tents on the plateau, they just bombed them. They didn't care who they were. And so it was very hard. It's not a war between two formal military forces. It's just one side of militia the most, and with women, children, monks, elderly, so on, all mixed together. On the other side was a formal military force fighting, and that was the reason why Tibetans has such a horrible casualty number. It's nearly 20% of the population at that time was involved in the actual battleground.
I'd love to go back to a point that you made earlier about the impact of Mao's directives, because from what you've just said, perhaps one question could be, well, if one side is a military and the other side is militia, but also lots of civilians, non-combatants all mixed up, you know, why was the war, why did it last 6 years? Maybe the assumption would be that it would be less time than that. And earlier you mentioned the impact of Mao's directives. So I'm wondering if you can tell us a bit more about them and what kind of the outcomes were of him issuing these orders.
Yeah, in 1959, Mao had, in early 1959, Mao had three telegraphs to Tibet Work Committee. Basically, he was saying, this war is good. He used the term war. The war is good. It gives us the opportunity to train the army and train the people. And we can just keep fighting that for 5 or 6 years or seven and 8 years. So then that will clear the way for democratic reform. Let me get back to this. And so this effectively, Mao gave a green light for the army to do whatever they want to do. Right, it's good. Because of this, they had no hesitation killing anyone, and they just see anyone as what they called, the term they used was rebel bandits, and when they see a group of those people, they just shoot, they just bomb. So why it took so long? Because traditional Tibet was very large. If we consider Kang, Andong, and central Tibet, it is like 1/4 of the total Chinese territory inside China now. So it was a large area, and it's high. Elevation is quite high, and the Han people really didn't know anything about this region, and the military had no experience in this region. The term they use is they conquer one place at a time, and then whatever region they conquered, they started the reform immediately in that region. So it's a slowly, one place at a time, and the army was sent from one place and another. That's the reason it took so long. They couldn't even had enough military to go all at once. And don't forget, at that time in 1958, there was a time it was also a time they had bombing of in the island in Taiwan. So they had a kind of like a war military action in the east and another military action in the west. And also that was also the time when China had the Great Famine. So a lot of factors put together.
I think that that's really helpful in placing this in context, but also understanding the intensity of it, right? With so many Tibetans being impacted. You spoke earlier about kind of the different audiences of the book, the Chinese audiences, what they might already know and what they bring to the book from that, versus English speaking or English reading audiences. Is there anything in addition about the book that you think is really important for particularly English reading audiences to know?
I would think the English audience, I would hope they pay more attention to the details. I tried to sort out all the details I can find and picture a much bigger picture. See, the last chapter of this book is like It's all collections of statistics from all source, Chinese sources. What happened to that time, how Tibet became an issue. We always say Tibet issue, but what is really a Tibet issue and why Tibet became an issue and what kind of issue it is. When you go through these details, you will have much better understanding why Tibetans continue to fight, to resist. From even though Dalai Lama has left Tibet for more than 60 years, but several generations of Tibetans were still fighting and still resisting Chinese occupation. And this has a lot to do with what China did, what the CCP did in Tibet. When you say how many Tibetans were impacted by this, I would say everyone, in one way or another. You were either being trained as activist and pushed forward to persecute your own people, your own monks, and or you were caught in the battlefield when you're trying to escape, or you became an exile. You became exiles in foreign land, or you were like some of them being used as like models and being used as a, what was the term? United Front targets and being treated well, but you have to be a mouthpiece for the government. One way or another, you were caught in this turmoil and you have no escape. That was the reason when I write about this book, I try to write the stories of the ordinary people, the nomads, the monks, the people who live in the remote part of Tibet or and also remote part of China. People didn't know that region exists. People didn't know, many of the Chinese didn't know those people, how they lived, what was their life before, what was their life after, and how they were caught in those events and which completely changed their lives, so on. It's a Tibetan issue. It's not only an issue of a group of elites, officials, or not even only an issue about Dalai Lama himself. It's about everyone of Tibetan people and their fate. And this is one of the major, a big part of my writing and my research process. So I interviewed many Tibetans, different levels, from officials to just nomads and monks, how they fared in this historical events.
Is there maybe one or two of those stories you could share with us now?
Yeah, the book which really deeply affected me actually is this old lady. I call her Amazoga. I interviewed her in India, and a couple of years after this, actually the same year when this book was published, I went to China for the last time, and after that, that was exactly about 10 years ago, and that was the last time I was allowed to enter China, and after that, I was banned. So I went to Tibet, which isn't Tibet, I would say, because I wasn't allowed to go to Central Tibet either, even if I was at the time when I was allowed to go to China. I visited that region and visited Dalai Lama's birthplace. And during this trip, accidentally, I went to a small village, just past that small village. It turned out to be Amazoga's hometown. That was where she escaped from. It was such a small place, middle of nowhere. I didn't even know when I know about this when I passed by. When I saw the roadside sign, I was screaming. I was like, wow, this is Amazonas village. And I could hardly imagine how she, as a young woman, escaped into from that place into central Tibet, into Lhasa. And then from Lhasa, went by herself into India. And she told me her life story. I still remember her. She's just like always in my mind when I talk about, when people ask me about that region. She was, she had big, this writing this about her had a big impact on myself. You know, her courage, her determination. And it's hard to form a big, I was like able to see her, follow her route. It's like from that small remote region, a village, all the way into India. It was completely life story.
Very impactful. So thank you for sharing that with us and for sharing the insights and importance of the book. I think it will be of interest to a lot of people because this is such a thing that has been hidden for, I think, many people for many decades. And this book does go through so much information and piece it all together to get that bigger picture. So thank you for sharing your time and expertise with us on the podcast. As a reminder to our listeners, the book is titled When the Iron Bird Flies, China's Secret War in Tibet. And the English version is just out in 2022 from Stanford University Press. Jianglin Li, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me.